I was exercising through the first North Carolina hurricane that came through, pounding rain, wind at unprecedented speeds, and I'm out there running through my neighborhood. If it was lightning, it didn't matter. I'd be outside still. If I was sick, still working out. I got shingles in my early 30s, and I was like angry. I was angry at myself and my body for getting that sickness. And as soon as I started to feel just a glimmer better, I was back to some of those punishing behaviors.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm, as always, so grateful for you tuning in, whether you are a longtime listener or this is your first episode. This show wouldn't be here without you listening, so if you have any topics that you would like to listen to, I haven't said this in a while, but please DM me, email me, go onto my website, and there's something called SpeakPipe, and you can send me a message, actually a voice message, and just let me know anything that you would like to hear this year. So grateful for you being here. Again, this podcast is for you, so I'd really like to hear the things that you want on the show. Okay, that being said, we have a guest here today who is going to share their personal story, which I always love because I think that when people are vulnerable enough to share their personal stories, then maybe somebody out there listening can relate, and that can help them to identify if they're struggling and hopefully get into some treatment or help that they need. But, you know, there is a version of recovery culture that quietly says that, like, if you're struggling, you must not be trying hard enough. And today's guest is really gonna dismantle that. Joanna is the author of When the Water Still Holds Me, and it's written as a series of letters to herself, to doctors, to treatment centers, to shame, to culture, because long-term eating disorders don't fit neatly into sound bites or these before and after narratives. She shares how her eating disorder started as a way to cope with grief and upheaval, and how compulsive exercise became its own kind of prison in her life, and how repeated ER visits and even cardiac admissions didn't always lead to real referrals or sustained support. And maybe somebody out there listening knows exactly what that's like, but I think it's important for us to talk about that. Like, what happens when you do seek help, and do you always get the treatment or the help that you need right away? And we're going to talk about what changed for her and her life, like love, values, community, and finding joyful movement in the water of all places after years of punishment. So very grateful for her to be here. I think you're going to really get something out of her story, lots of ups and downs. And if any of you out there have ever felt unseen by the system or feel like you don't quote unquote qualify for help, I just want you to sit back and listen to what she has to say. Like I said, very grateful for her to be here, and I'm just going to go grab her and we're going to start. All right. Well, Johanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm really grateful for this opportunity.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. And, you know, part of the reason I started the podcast was I really wanted to get people on who are willing to share their stories because, and I don't know how it was for you, but when I was going through this like so long ago, I didn't know anyone who had an eating disorder. There was nothing out there. And I wish there would have been information or somebody would have shared something, because I had no idea I even had an eating disorder. So I'd love to hear from your like story, your journey, Like, when did it start? And just like, what were the things that you initially like started noticing in yourself that maybe got your mind thinking like, maybe something's not right? So I'd love to just hear from yourself, like where this all started and what was going on in your life. And then we'll just go from there.
Yeah, thank you. And I can definitely relate to that. You know, I was a child of the 80s and 90s, dating myself a little there. And you're right. I mean, there wasn't media like there is today. And I grew up in rural Vermont, in rural Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And this was not something, you know, I really had any knowledge of. And even when my eating disorder started, and I'll, you know, speak to that again, I had not really seen anybody, heard of anybody's experience with an eating disorder. I didn't even really realize that what I was engaging in was an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of always say my childhood was really idealistic, utopian, very fortunate to have that. And when I was 15, I was living in Massachusetts at that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a variety of things that were going on in that season of life. My parents got divorced, and that was a pretty transformative moment for me. You know, grew up with two parents that were very involved, poured everything into us, and kind of had that image of perfection. And again, I wouldn't change that for anything, but it made the announcement of the divorce even that more like heartbreaking and shattering. And I had kind of that personality trait of not wanting to be the burden, and kept my emotions really tight to myself, kind of just push them down. And, you know, through that, I really found other ways to kind of deal with some of that inner turmoil. In that season, you know, my sister, she was my best friend. She's a couple years older than I am, you know, that role model that she always was. For me, she had gone off to college. So that was another pretty significant loss during that time. My beloved grandpa passed away. And so there was just a lot of loss, it felt like, of, you know, everything in my life. And I turned to restriction at that point. And again, it wasn't an intentional thing. I didn't set out to, you know, eat less and move more. Movement was another piece of my struggle. It was really a way to like numb and to not face the emotions that I didn't know how to hold as a 15-year-old.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of changes all at once. And that's pretty typical. You know, there's like some like big life transitions or some big change that, or something's going on. When I talk to people, look back, it's like, okay, what was really going on there? It's not just something happens out of the blue typically. So
yeah, I know it felt like all of these things were out of control. And again, not in a conscious way, but controlling my food was a way to kind of bring some stability and safety when everything else felt pretty tumultuous. And then I was an athlete. You know, I grew up playing sports. I love sports. Soccer was my main sport over all the years, but I dipped in and out of a variety of sports. And that became very embedded in the behaviors that I was engaging in. You know, I would spend a lot of time beyond kind of the typical training that I should have been doing at that point as a high school and club athlete. And again, it was a way to just disconnect from the world. And it became very interwoven into, again, my eating disorder over all the years.
Now, were you ever getting positive feedback or praise for anything that maybe made it more confusing? Like, oh, I'm doing the right things, or this is a good thing to do, or...
Yeah, no. I always think back to when I was in college. In the off season, I was in the gym training in the athletic center, and my college coach at the time kind of poked his head in and just jokingly, as he was leaving, called me a gym rat. And I had never heard that term before. And, you know, he said it kind of playfully and affectionately, as, you know, oh, you're so dedicated and passionate, you know, you're just spending all your time here. And yet he did not realize the compulsion that was behind my need to be in the gym, well beyond, again, what should have been really normal for a college athlete in that time.
Like, do you remember back then, like how much time you were spending in the gym?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot. I think back to college in general of how small and isolated my world became. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have very vivid memories of roommates, you know, gathering for hot cocoa and, you know, movies or playing cards or going to the student hall. And I put on my, you know, sneakers and headed to the gym. And mm-hmm. I was a two-sport collegiate athlete. And so that was very demanding on my time. But we would come back from an out-of-state game, and I would, you know, everyone else would be grabbing their kind of gear from the bus and heading back to their dorm, and I would be heading through the gym doors to, you know, really engage in hours more of exercise until the gym closed.
Do you remember, I mean, it's probably a while ago, but do you remember why you felt like the need to go to the gym even after you just got back from a game?
Yeah. It was a compulsion. Like it's really hard to kind of get into my mind at that time, other than there was such guilt if I didn't, you know, engage in those behaviors. It felt like it gave me permission to eat during the day. If I didn't move and I didn't move kind of to the amount that I had created in my mind was the right number of minutes or the right number of reps that I did, it really then impacted what I would, you know, eat and how I would nourish myself that day. But sometimes it's hard. It was just a pull. And sometimes it was an unexplainable pull. But if I didn't do it, kind of the anxiety that I could feel throughout my body was almost unbearable.
Like, was there ever a part of you watching your friends like have their hot cocoa nights and all this where you're like, oh, I really want to just do that, but you didn't allow yourself for some reason?
Yeah, definitely. And that kind of carried through a lot of seasons of life of looking back. And there's a lot of grief and still sadness there of all the things I missed out on because I chose my eating disorder over and over and over again. And it didn't fill kind of what I think, you know, I was trying to fill at that time. But yeah, I mean, I can look back and remember those times where friends were laughing and telling stories and I was already in my head calculating what I had eaten that day, you know, what I had to do when I got to the gym. I'm just so disconnected from everyone around me.
Like, it sounds like you had these very specific numbers in your head, and I don't want to get specific, but
yeah,
it sounds like you had, like, it didn't count for exercise if it wasn't like a certain amount of time or reps. Or I'm just wondering, did you have like this mental path going on with like, okay, this counteracts X amount of calories I'm eating? Or like, how did that work in your head?
Yeah, it definitely did. And I think, you know, over the years when new behaviors were added, you know, kind of into the equation per se, thinking about the math, it was something then I couldn't change or I couldn't break. Like once something new started, a new pattern started, a new behavior started, a new way of doing something, that became the new norm. And so it just kind of built and built and built. Calorie counting was something that I struggled with for decades. That number was constant. I mean, I could be talking to somebody and the numbers would still be running kind of in the background. And I would do it, you know, on pieces of paper. I would get out a calculator and do it. And I knew the number, I was eating a very kind of narrow list of food at that point. And yet I needed that confirmation and that verification. And it was the same with movement. Again, I kind of had each day had a different kind of workout in my mind. And it was very regimented of how much time I spent, you know, kind of on this machine, how many reps I did of this exercise. And it was just an unbreakable pattern for a long, long time.
Like, what would happen if you got sick? Do you remember?
I pushed through. I speak to that in my memoir, actually, about, you know, when I first, it was a couple of years after college, but I had moved to North Carolina, where I live now. But, you know, I was exercising through the first North Carolina hurricane that came through, pounding rain, wind at unprecedented speeds, and I'm out there running through my neighborhood. You know, if it was lightning, it didn't matter. I'd be outside still. If I was sick, still working out. I got shingles in my early 30s and I was like angry. I was angry at myself and my body for getting that sickness. And as soon as I started to feel just a glimmer better, I was back to some of those punishing behaviors.
Did you think it was punishing back then, or is this all in hindsight?
A little bit of both. I think over the years, I recognized again that it was the impact it was having on my body, the impact it was having on, you know, the world, in which I was in, and, you know, again, kind of the isolation that I lived in. I definitely think hindsight has added to recognizing how punishing it was. You know, I think if I had known really back then what I was doing and what I was doing to my body, I'd like to think that, you know, it may have looked a little different.
Was anyone giving you any comments or feedback like that kind of clued you in terms of, hey, maybe these behaviors aren't the best? Or were you actually getting like validation, like, oh my gosh, you're so healthy, you're so athletic, like, I wish I could be like you? Like, what was actually going on with the outside world?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a mixture. I think, you know, thinking back to like high school and college, when you're in that kind of athletic mindset and again, wore that mask of, you know, high functioning and perfectionism and drive and dedication, I think it went unnoticed for many years by coaches and by classmates and peers and other athletes on my team. You know, my loved ones though were definitely the ones that shared the most concern. Especially my mom, you know, she was standing there watching me every year slip farther and farther into this illness and tried everything she could to get me the support I needed, you know, to really advocate for me when we went to doctor's offices and, you know, things were dismissed. But I lived in that denial. I didn't want to face it. And, you know, I kind of responded with a lot of anger towards her in that season, withdrawal, again, I kind of said, I'm fine constantly. And the more I said it, the more I tried to just believe it.
So were doctors picking up on it? Or what was the experience when you went to the doctor's office?
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, I have a chapter in my memoir called Dear Doctors. And I talk about some of my early experiences. And it's not, you know, a letter to write blame towards doctors. I firmly believe doctors are doing the best that they can with the education they've had and the resources that they had. But, you know, some of my earliest memories of going to the doctor, when I was in high school, you know, my mom brought me to the emergency room numerous times when I was kind of keeled over in pain, you know, my body's earliest attempts to voice that something was wrong, you know, dehydrated, depleted. And I'd be given pain medicine, you know, I'd be left there for hours to rest, and then I'd be discharged. And that happened a lot throughout my experience. You know, admissions to cardiac floors, same, you know, kept overnight, and then discharge paper, no referrals, no, you know, really recommendations about what would come next. And so, you know, kind of part of my advocacy is bringing awareness to doctors in, you know, what they can do, what questions they can ask. But yes, especially in those early years, doctors did not really point out what was going on or help, you know, direct me towards, you know, care that I really needed at that time.
And curious too, like, was there any part of you that thought, oh, maybe I'm actually struggling with an illness? Or like, what was going on in your head when you were going to the ER or cardiac units? Or, I mean, what's going on?
I mean, and it's so hard. I mean, as a 15-year-old, again, in those early years, I was very stubborn and very much in denial as a young adolescent. And so it's almost like the points weren't connecting. I mean, here I was in the emergency room, and yet, you know, as soon as I left, like, it didn't cross my mind again about the seriousness of what I was doing. That definitely started to shift, you know, the older I got, when I did end up in the hospital or the cardiac floor, you know, I'd kind of cry through the night of just, I'm going to do better. I'm going to, you know, really meet the goals. I'm going to get back with my outpatient team. And it was almost, you know, each of those times I would be able to, for a few weeks, put into place some of those different, you know, kind of tools in my toolkit. And then inevitably, you know, kind of the next wave would come and I would just fall back into a lot of the behaviors that led me there in the first place. So what, and then it became that self-defeating, you know, then I just would get so mad at myself.
So what were they telling you to change or do when you got discharged?
Well, and that's the thing is that from, you know, it was different when I did higher levels of care, but for just like general emergency room visits or cardiac floor visits, there weren't recommendations. And I think that that reinforced the message in my mind that I wasn't sick enough. I, you know, this wasn't that serious of a problem. It kind of echoed the voices that I was telling myself, despite, you know, I think I could see the frustration on my mom's face every time we left because, you know, she was fighting so hard for me to be seen and for the seriousness of it to be recognized, not only myself recognizing it, but for others to recognize it. And again, we just weren't given a lot of the referrals and recommendations that should have been there.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like at some point you did recognize, okay, this is something eating disordered because you did get into treatment. And so I'm wondering when was that? Because it sounds like there was all of this going on and then there was like some turning point where it's like, oh wait, actually this is something different.
Yep. So it was about a decade later. So when I was, it was right around 24, 25, I was working with an incredible outpatient team at that time. When I moved to North Carolina a couple years after college, so it had been, you know, probably about 6 years into my eating disorder, I began working with an outpatient team that specialized in eating disorders. And that was my first level opportunity to have specialized treatment. When I was living in Massachusetts, when my eating disorder began, I did have a therapist. He did not specialize in eating disorders. That was so rare, again, in rural Massachusetts and in the early 2000s. I didn't have a psychiatrist. I didn't have a medical doctor that specialized. I didn't have a dietitian. And so, you know, I try to give myself grace that in those early years, a lot of rewiring happened because I didn't have a lot of that support. And so when I did move to North Carolina and I had a specialized team, they were a gift and a blessing during that time to really have just people that understood from a different perspective. And the therapist I was working with and my mom staged in kind of like, I call it an intervention, but they both sat down with me. My mom showed up at an appointment. I didn't know she was coming. And they just both voiced really the concern that they had for where I was. It was probably one of my most shadowed seasons, you know, where I was struggling. And I saw it, you know, I recognized that if I continued kind of on the path I was going, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. And so at that point I did want help. I wanted to, you know, get better, to have my life look different than how it looked. And I was willing to kind of surrender and go to higher level of care. And so it was a really hard season going to that higher level of care. But in many ways, that first, you know, opportunity that I had to go to treatment really saved my life.
So for people who are listening and going, wait, and I've talked about this on the podcast, but maybe people haven't listened going, wait, what's the difference between outpatient and therapy and then going to a higher level of care? Because there's actually different levels. So I'm wondering for you, what was your first entrance into higher level of care?
Yeah. So for outpatient, so I saw my outpatient team once a week. So I saw my therapist once a week and my dietitian once a week, and then checked in with kind of my doctor and psychiatrist as needed. When I went to higher level of care, I went to a residential program. It was across the country. So that was, you know, a big shift as well. I wasn't close to home. I wasn't close to family, but was very, again, grateful for that opportunity. And so residential is 24/7. You know, you live kind of, they have bedrooms and I had roommates kind of during my stay there, and you stay on site. And I was at that residential level of care for about a month and a half. And then I transitioned to their partial hospitalization program. Mm-hmm. And for that specific program, their PHP was 7 days a week, 12 hours a day of programming. They gave us, those of us that were out of state stayed at an apartment complex at a, you know, they offered a nice prorated cost. So there was a group of us that stayed at the apartments, and I always call it like the white van came in the morning, you know, before the sun rose, we loaded onto the bus and were brought over to the facility, and we were there until dark and then brought back to the apartments. And that was 7 days a week.
Okay. Wow. So was there any disruption that you felt to your day-to-day life? Was it scary to go? Was there like a hesitation to go? Because I know a lot of people go, oh gosh, I can't take time out of my life to go to that kind of a treatments. And so I'm just wondering for you, like, what was going on when you were told about residential?
Yeah, for that first time that I went, again, I was in such a place that I wasn't able to work during that season. I have been a lifelong teacher and educator. Mm-hmm. And so I had stepped away from the classroom, had moved back with my mom, and was kind of waiting for my admission to that program. And, you know, in that point, there was hesitation. I think with anything, change is scary. Knowing that, you know, I was going to be challenged on my eating disorder was really, really scary. Mm-hmm. And yet I also knew that it was the care that I needed. And I had that hope and that desire for things to look different, for my life to not be so constrained by the rigidity that my eating disorder brought. And so although I was really scared, I also was really hopeful at the same time.
Okay. Did you have any fears going into treatment? Because I know a lot of people have a lot of fears going into treatment about what's going to happen to their body or what's going to just happen in general. So I don't know if you had any.
Yeah, all of the above. I had fear of what foods I was going to have to eat. Very fearful of that, since my list had become very narrow before I went to treatment. So that was terrifying. I feared what my body was going to, you know, do. I had lost so much trust in my body, you know, believing it knew what it needed. I had micromanaged it and controlled it for so long that there was fear of just letting go and letting it, you know, heal in ways that it needed to. Mm-hmm. I feared not being able to move. That was also really embedded, that movement piece. And so that was a big fear that I had. I feared kind of the perception of those that knew I was in treatment. Again, I carried a lot of shame for struggling with a mental illness that has a lot of stereotypes and, you know, a lot of misunderstanding. And so I really feared kind of what that perception was from others. So there was definitely a lot of fear going into it. And I think one of the biggest fears too was not knowing kind of what was going to be on the other side. I had a lot of hope, but I also feared that I would put in all the work, I would spend all the time there, and I'd end up kind of right back at square one. So yeah, a lot of fear, but I'm glad that the fear didn't prevent me from going. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's very brave of you to talk about, because I think a lot of times, you know, there is still the shame of having the eating disorder. And I don't know, did you have any challenges there in terms of like opening up and being really honest with your treatment team?
Most definitely. At one point, my team told me I was the perfect patient because I was, you know, again, following all the rules, not really showing the emotion, you know, putting on that mask that everything was fine. And I'm just kind of pushing through. I've never been one who likes to cry in front of other people. And so really allowing myself to let my guard down while I was there, whether it was in individual sessions or in group, you know, kind of group therapies, it was really hard for me. But I think over the months, it got a little easier as I got more comfortable with my treatment team, with the others that were there, the other amazing folks that I met. But it's never been easy. Shame is definitely something that's been one of the hardest things to let go of. For a long time, I kind of have always seen my eating disorder as my greatest weakness until I started to really view it differently. But yeah, it's an area where I've always considered, you know, I've told myself I'm a failure, or I'm just not good enough, or I'm not strong enough for being able to overcome this, versus, you know, seeing it for what it is.
So how do you see it differently now versus before?
Yeah. You know, I see it now as, you know, one of my strengths. I try to really see that when it developed, I was, you know, I was young and I was doing the best that I could in that season. And for a long time, I was doing the best that I could. And I look back and I see the perseverance that I had, even though I didn't always, you know, see it in that time. It definitely takes a lot to keep showing up every day. I always say that for those that are on this journey and those that are on this long journey, like to just keep showing up every day, whether, you know, you're just barely, you know, getting by or you're having a fantastic day. It's hard. It's a hard thing to have in your life every single day. I also, you know, really started, I have always really resonated with acceptance and commitment therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I think really when I had a shift a handful of years ago of living my life really focused more on my values, I was able to let go of some of that shame and self-hatred I had for struggling so for so long, and really lean into some more of that compassion and that kindness. And it's not always easy. There's still days that I get really frustrated when, you know, I slip back into, you know, a behavior or a thought, but I'm able to offer myself a lot more compassion than I ever was able to in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, I mean, just from what you're sharing, it sounds like it was very functional at the time that you needed it. Mm-hmm. And so it made sense. And I'm wondering if you ever started to look at it like that versus like something that you needed to be ashamed of and something that you did that was so wrong or bad.
Yeah, I definitely have been able to have that shift. I think it comes with wisdom and time and age, mm-hmm. but to be able to look back and, you know, in a lot of ways, it was like a lifeboat in that season. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what kind of kept me afloat when a lot of things were happening. And then again, over all the years when I didn't, you know, kind of have the support in place, or, you know, people didn't see it for what it was. Mm-hmm. Again, it just got really ingrained. And so I can look back now and yeah, see it a lot differently than I did at the time.
Mm-hmm. And so you were in residential, then PHP. Mm-hmm. And then, so what happened from that point forward in terms of like your like journey into recovery?
Yeah. So I left that program. I got back into teaching. Teaching was mm-hmm. such a joy from a professional standpoint. Being an elementary school teacher is, you know, one of the greatest gifts to just be surrounded by kiddos mm-hmm. every day. Mm-hmm. And so I taught for many, many years. And my recovery really ebbed and flowed. I had, you know, years where I was definitely in a stronger place. I always had a consistent outpatient team. So that dietitian and therapist that I worked with and working on different goals. Again, it was never what I always called full recovery, but just that constant work in progress. Mm-hmm. And then I did have seasons over the years where it did become more challenging. You know, I had more stays in residential levels mm-hmm. of care, partial hospitalization levels of care. I've done a variety of intensive outpatient. So that's a few times a week. And again, the privilege in all of that to continue to have the care. And I continued to teach. I moved into different roles as well. I became a head of school, an assistant head of school, then kind of gravitated back into the classroom. And then about 5 years ago is when things, I'd like to say from kind of a recovery standpoint, really started to shift. And there was a variety of things that made me really reevaluate what recovery means and what healing means for me.
What shifted, if you don't mind asking?
Yeah, no, definitely. So one of the main things is I met my now husband. He is an incredible soul, my anchor. He's come into my life and been one of the greatest supports in, you know, walking alongside me. So walking alongside someone who has an eating disorder, he's never seen it as, you know, a weakness, something that needs to be fixed. He's endlessly, you know, accommodating. He listens. He's joined me in, you know, different, you know, therapist and dietitian appointments just so that he learns and learns how he can be a support. But I really started to see that, you know, for decades, my eating disorder was my world and no one and nothing, you know, mattered more. It was very isolating. Mm-hmm. Other than, you know, going to work every day, I didn't have friends. I didn't have a social life. You know, I spent most of my time moving, exercising. I didn't want to have to change what I would eat that day. And so I lived kind of just on my own. And then when we met, that all really shifted. For the first time, something mattered more. And that was building a life with him. Mm-hmm. He has four incredible kiddos. And so being able to be part of their life has been such an amazing thing as well. And so again, it hasn't been, you know, that kind of linear recovery journey that for a long time I thought is how it was going to look. But it's been a beautiful journey with him. And then kind of the other two pieces I would say is, I had an injury. So all the years of, you know, really punishing my body through exercise and compulsive exercise, I had a stress fracture in my foot that was really challenging. And I was in an intensive outpatient program at the time. And my therapist, you know, said, "Have you ever thought about swimming?" And I paused because anytime I had ever been in treatment before, exercise, you know, was kind of the unspoken. And if you're ever going to be recovered, you can never move your body, is some of the early messages I got when I was in treatment when I was younger. I know that message has started to shift in the eating disorder world, but that was really ingrained in me. Another reason why I felt like I was never going to recover, because I was continuing to move. But I started to swim, and for the first time, I felt like joyful movement had returned. And I hadn't felt that since I was a young girl on a soccer field. And really being in the water was transformative in a lot of ways in my healing.
No, I mean, I love that you said that, because, you know, the joyful movement part. And I think exercise is so dicey, right? When you're in an eating disorder, it's not about anything other than what you discussed before, like this, you know, earning your food, calorie counting, all, it's like almost like a purging technique. It's not about movement and enjoying moving in your body, right? And so just to hear you say that, like, oh, I enjoyed being in my body and moving. And so I was just going to ask, like, what's your relationship with exercise now? Do you look at it at all disordered, or is it completely different?
It really is so different. And that has been one of the greatest gifts on this journey. And in the last few years is, you know, I loved, you know, being an athlete. And that was such a strong part of my identity when I was younger. And, you know, really through soccer and being on the soccer field was where I found so much joy as a kid. And then when my eating disorder developed, yes, I still participated in sports and I really enjoyed that aspect, but it was so, you know, consumed by all the extra that I did. And that's where I really lost touch with moving with intention, moving with joy and purpose. So when I found myself in the pool, again, I hesitated because I was like, oh, I'm not really sure I want to even go swimming. Like, you know, it's not my thing. And lo and behold, I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, the pool community is delightful. Just, you know, pausing at the end of a lap lane with somebody, I feel like, you know, I know everybody kind of at the pool where I go. It's a local pool that we have here. And just to be able to, you know, chat with people has been really nice to bring back that connection when you're moving. And then there's just something really meditative about being in the water and just kind of the breath and just kind of your whole mind clears when you're in the water. It's, you know, just a disconnect from everything else and a connection with your body. You have to be really aware of where you are in the pool, especially when others are swimming with you. But yeah, it's been just a beautiful thing. And it's not, you know, there's no really disordered thoughts with it, which is such a shift. And I didn't expect that either, but it's just so different than all the years I spent kind of numbing out and zoning out in the gym.
That's wonderful. Right. I think it's still such a hard concept for people to think of exercise or movement as anything other than for weight loss. Right. And just, gosh, to just reiterate that over and over, there's a purpose to movement and it's not for that. And
right.
So thank you for sharing that, because it is.
You're welcome. I know. And I would love, you know, I did a little bit of research on aqua relational therapy, and it's not really applied to eating disorders. It's used in a lot of other areas of mental health, but I just see so much potential there, because it really is about embodiment and becoming, you know, in tune with your body and your body's wisdom and trusting it and trusting it in the water. And so, yeah, it's an area that I want to keep exploring.
Awesome. Okay. So, you said that was about 5 years ago you met your now partner. And so like the trajectory now, so where are you at now with things? And I know along the way you wrote this memoir, so I did want to talk about that as well. So I'm wondering if that was also part of your healing. So,
yeah, it really was. So a couple years into our marriage, so I guess it was probably maybe 3 years ago, again, was just in a really strong season. You know, many thanks to kind of him and our relationship and the life we were creating. And, you know, we were being able to travel, something I had never done before, and time with the kids, and just all of these things of the life I always had dreamed of, was I was really living it. And so I had left the classroom at that time and had started a degree in clinical mental health counseling. Had always said if I had found myself in a strong season to, you know, enter the field, because I had so many gifted and incredible providers who helped me along my journey. And I was in a course that was called addictions counseling and was learning about substance abuse and harm reduction. Mm-hmm. And I was also trying to secure my internship and had learned about just a local facility that's a peer led day program, again, for substance abuse. And harm reduction and peer support kind of sparked in me, why aren't these more woven in the eating disorder world? Mm-hmm. And so my husband came home. It was just about a year ago from work. And I said to him, I'm pausing grad school and I'm going to write a memoir. It's something I've always wanted to do. And I'm going to launch a nonprofit. And kind of the theme with both of them is kind of that paradigm shift of how we treat eating disorders, how we view recovery / healing, with that harm reduction lens, that it can be, you know, nonlinear, it can be complex, it can be nuanced, it can be personalized. And so I really devoted the last year to the memoir and to the nonprofit.
Wonderful. So this memoir, can you tell us the title? And then I did want to just ask a few things about it as well.
Yeah. So the title is When the Water Still Holds Me, Letters Through the Tides of a Long-Term Eating Disorder. And it's written as a series of letters. And so the letters, you know, range from kind of letters to myself during different seasons. So early childhood, it's all water themes. So kind of the first ripple. So again, kind of that season where I was, when my eating disorder developed, and then when I was really lost in the waves and the currents, and then kind of transitions to letters to people and places. So I have letters to teachers and coaches, to doctors, to treatment centers, and then just a theme. So letters towards like dear shame, stigma, and stereotypes, dear culture, dear body, dear love. And really my hope is, you know, it makes people, whether, you know, they struggle with an eating disorder or not, to feel more seen and more understood. It's really to bring a voice to something that's not spoken about a lot. You know, long-term eating disorders are often left out of conversations, or kind of the complexity of them, and those that may not fit that narrow definition of recovery are left out. And I really wanted to bring attention to the fact that healing is very personal, and you can have meaning in your life and, you know, have joy and a career and partnership and whatever, you know, you desire while you're still healing. And that doesn't mean that you're not good enough or that you're a failure, kind of all those messages that, you know, I internalized. And then again, kind of that overarching theme of the principles of harm reduction, just because that has been such a gift in my own recovery of seeing how, you know, I can make small strides. I have autonomy. I have, you know, kind of that care that is offered with dignity and humanity. And so kind of bringing that again into the eating disorder conversation as well.
So for people who may have never heard that term harm reduction, and especially in the context of eating disorders, like how could you explain that to people who are going, wait, what does that mean?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's often, you often hear it with substance abuse. But harm reduction is really meeting people where they are, not believing that, you know, the elimination of all behaviors is the only path. And so it meets people where they are at any given time. And it's meant to give people kind of that autonomy to define, you know, what goals they want to be working on. It helps them kind of, again, make that small incremental progress. And it can be really empowering. And so, you know, when I think about it in the world of eating disorders and just from my own personal experience, you know, a couple of concrete examples is, you know, movement. For a long time, it was very black and white. If you move, then you're not recovered or you're never going to be, versus, you know, what ways can you move that honor, you know, your body and honor, you know, your healing. And so whether it's, you know, if somebody likes to say, you know, take a yoga class every single day, and maybe in this season that's not, you know, helpful to their recovery, then, you know, doesn't mean can't do yoga at all, but how maybe can you take a one day of rest during the week? When it comes to food, for myself, I held a lot of shame for a long time of needing a meal plan. I thought that I should be farther along, that I should be able to eat intuitively, that I shouldn't need that structure. And I really came to view it differently, that structure is what actually gives me freedom to live my life. And it is what keeps me afloat. And so, you know, I've kind of let go of the shame of needing a meal plan and recognizing, you know, kind of having that outlined throughout the day is what gives me the nourishment I need to chase after my puppy and, you know, give my husband a hug and to do all the things that I love and enjoy. And so, again, harm reduction is really a person-centered approach.
I love that. Right. I heard a lot of the shoulds in there, like the perfectionistic and you is coming out, right? Like I should be this, I should be that. But to your point, everybody's got their own path and journey and struggles. And I love that because it's so much more compassionate than shaming. Mm-hmm. So, so if people do want to find your book, how can they do that?
Yeah. So I have a paperback and an ebook and both can be found on Amazon. Nice. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. And then are you teaching now or are you helping people? What's going on?
Yeah. Here? Thank you for asking. So I'm not in the classroom anymore. Again, that was such a wonderful time career-wise. But when I kind of paused to do grad school and then paused now to do the memoir and to launch the nonprofit, now that the memoir has launched into the world, really shifting my focus back to my nonprofit. So I started, it's called A Dragonfly's Dream, and it is a peer-led harm reduction, mind-body, you know, approach. And so starting some in-person here in the Raleigh area where I am, peer-led groups, again, kind of weaving in some of that harm reduction. So come where you are, you don't have to be perfect or in, you know, believe that you're completely recovered to come and participate, and weaving in again some of that mind body connection as well. And down the road, I hope to have a podcast one day. And then really long-term vision is to open a peer-led day program where, again, harm reduction kind of principles are the overarching theme. There's opportunities, you know, for nature and for, you know, I'd love to have, you know, an aqua therapy group. But just again, different ways to treat eating disorders, kind of the care that I wish that I had over all of the years.
Oh my God, that's phenomenal. Well, wonderful. And is there a website for your nonprofit?
Yes. So for A Dragonfly's Dream, it's www.adragonfliesdream.com. And there's a lot of information there. Meant to add to the peer-led support group, starting in person, but hoping to have in the next month or two a virtual group as well. So we have a farther reach.
Lovely. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I will have that all in the show notes.
Wonderful.
Wow. I really appreciate you sharing all of this. And any last final words before we end?
No, it really was a pleasure to be here today and to be able to share my story. You know, I think just for anyone listening, whether you know, you're on your own journey or you're supporting someone who is, just hold on to that hope. And I always like to say, you know, you know yourself best and really believe in your inner light and the life that you want to create, you know, really use that as your North Star.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much. Appreciate it.
No, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.